Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Jim Bell is a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. His new book is The Interstellar Age, Inside the 40-Year Voyager Mission, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jim Bell to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
You have written on the subject, obviously, of space exploration before, Postcards from Mars. What brought you to Voyager and its 40-year history?
You know, this is Voyager's how I got my start in the business, in planetary science and space exploration. I was an undergraduate working with a mentor who was a member of the camera team for the Voyagers, and a guy named Ed Danielson, super amazing person, and just provided me the opportunity to get on the ground floor as a student of some of the adventures of the spacecraft, and just seeing it firsthand really influenced my career.
Give us a sense of the timeline and how this got started, of where this fit into the timeline and to the ultimate history of the space program.
Sure. The Voyagers were launched in 1977. And at the time, they were designed to go farther than any previous spacecraft at NASA or anybody else. There had been missions to the moon or Mercury and Venus, Mars, relatively close by. But these missions were designed to go way out into the outer solar system, maybe having to last a decade or more. So it was unprecedented. And of course, we didn't know much about the outer solar system back then. We could see planets like Jupiter and Saturn through telescopes, but they were kind of fuzzy blobs. And their moons were just dots, just points of light. We had no idea what those places were really like. So the goal was to discover, to go look, get up close, take pictures, make other measurements, discover what these places were like. And that's been incredibly successful.
I want you to talk a little bit more about the successes of what we have ultimately learned from this project, and also where it has failed in some ways that you outline in the book.
Right. So, you know, the things we've learned have literally changed the textbooks. Like getting up close, especially to the moons of the outer solar system. You know, we had no idea that Jupiter's moon Io is the most volcanically active world in the solar system, much more volcanically active than the Earth. That Jupiter's moon Europa has a deep ocean under an icy crust, and that ocean is salty and has more water than all the oceans on the Earth. That Saturn's big moon Titan has a thick atmosphere, smoggy, hazy organic molecule atmosphere that might be what the early Earth's atmosphere was like. Or that all four giant planets have rings. We thought maybe just Saturn had rings. So all these things weren't known, and they've all been discovered by flying past these systems up close, getting as close as possible, threading the needle so we could go from one planet to the next. I don't think there's been any failures of Voyager. Maybe the only shortcoming is that they are flyby missions. They had to go by just once, very fast. And so if you've never seen a place before and you pass by once, you're going to learn a huge amount of information about what that place is like. But you might have wanted to stay, you know, and get to know the place even better. And we've had the opportunity with follow-on missions after Voyager to go back to Jupiter and orbit and spend a long time there, go back to Saturn and orbit and spend a bunch of time there. And those follow-on missions couldn't have happened without the initial flyby of Voyager.
You talk about how much this, as you say, it changed the textbooks. And sometimes the textbooks change, and maybe they need to be changed back. I speak of Pluto and this being a planet. You believe it should be called a planet again.
I do. I never stopped calling it a planet,
yeah.
Personally. I think, you know, I judge a place, and I'm a little odd compared to many of my astronomy friends. I judge a place not by where it is, but by what it's like, especially on the inside. And, you know, Pluto is representative of a class of objects in our solar system that are big enough to have become spherical, that are probably separated into a core, mantle, and a crust, that have atmosphere, that have moons of their own, that probably have had interesting, varied geologic history, in my book, there's 30 or 40 planets in our solar system, places that meet those requirements, especially the part about having had an interesting and evolving geologic history or atmospheric history. You know, Jupiter has a couple of moons that are bigger than the planet Mercury. Why aren't they planets? Just because they happen to be orbiting around Jupiter. It doesn't matter so much where they are. What matters is what they're like, especially what they're like on the inside. That's how I judge a planet.
And I should mention, this comes up in your story because Voyager was almost directed to fly by Pluto.
Yeah, that was one of the options. You know, scientists had to choose between going to Pluto or flying very close by Saturn's large moon, Titan. Couldn't do both, couldn't make the trajectory work for both. And at the time, you know, we knew a little bit about Titan from telescope measurements, but much, much less about Pluto. And what we knew about Titan was telling us that we probably could learn about much more about our own planet and the early history of our own planet by studying Titan compared to Pluto. So Pluto was ranked less important, and the mission went on to Titan. Now, luckily, a subsequent mission was launched in 2006, and then we'll get to Pluto this summer, July 14th. A mission called New Horizons will fly right through the Pluto system, and we'll get our first up-close look at that place.
You write in the book, and it's one of the most fascinating sort of pop culture sections in the book, about the Golden Record. This is the what you refer to as the greatest concept album ever, led in part by Carl Sagan, which I was not aware of. And this is fascinating how this came to be. Why did they decide to even have a Golden Record?
You know, this was the brainchild of Carl Sagan. He and others realized the opportunity to basically put a message in a bottle. They knew that these spacecraft would be accelerated to escape the gravity of the sun, that they would be floating through space for tens, hundreds of millions of years, that they were likely, because there's no erosion or rain out there, they're likely to outlive our civilization. They're likely to outlive our species. So why not put something there, a time capsule, that captures the essence of who we are, what we've achieved as a civilization, in that bottle, that kind of message in that bottle. And so each spacecraft has a phonograph record inside a case mounted on the side of the spacecraft. And that phonograph record contains a couple of dozen songs representing all the cultures of the world, from classical, jazz, rock and roll, indigenous music. It has greetings from world leaders, children. It has photos inscribed, etched into the recording as well, of people doing regular people things, eating and farming, and some of our technology and some of our architecture, kind of, you know, snapshot of life and culture on the Earth in the mid-1970s, cast like a message in a bottle out into the universe. It's unlikely that anybody will ever see it. In fact, in my opinion, it might be us. We might be the ones to actually see it next in the far future, when we become interstellar travelers and have the technology to catch up with the Voyagers and very hopefully, carefully, and lovingly scoop them up and put them into a museum.
Do we know what shape they're in?
We know that the computer systems and electronics are healthy because we're still in contact with them. We know their trajectories. There's not enough power to run the cameras, but many other instruments are being operated to measure the magnetic field and cosmic rays, et cetera. And so they're in good shape. They're still in good working order. And, you know, there's nothing to, they're not going to run into anything. There's no stars or planets along their path, at least for the foreseeable future. And there's the erosion out there is extremely slow. You know, occasional cosmic ray might put a micro pit in the surface of the cover of the record, but it'll take millions and millions of years for those pits to build up to anything meaningful. And they could easily last hundreds of millions of years or more. They could loop around the galaxy like the sun in orbit around the Milky Way many, many times.
You alluded to this, but Voyager 2 leaves the solar system this year. So where are we right now?
So both spacecraft are way out there, more than 10 billion with a B, miles away. They're traveling incredibly fast. They've been slingshot accelerated by passing close to the giant planets. So they're each traveling at more than 10 miles per second. You know, and you try to imagine something passing through your neighborhood at 10 miles per second. That's pretty impressive. And they've left the bubble that surrounds the sun. The sun, like all other stars, has a bubble, spherical bubble surrounding it, where all the magnetic fields and particles of the solar wind create this little bubble in space around the star. And Voyager 1 popped out of that bubble in 2012. And Voyager 2 is going to pop out this year or next year. And both spacecraft are actively measuring the interstellar environment, the space between the stars. What is that like? This is the first time we're getting that information.
How do you feel about the overall state of our space program? Once incredibly vibrant and now dormant, rather.
Well, not quite dormant. I mean, we still have a very active robotic space exploration program. Rovers on Mars and orbiters around Mercury and Venus and Saturn and missions back to the moon and other planets. The Pluto mission I talked about can fly by this summer. So that's been very, very active, consistently active, and fairly well supported, although everything is suffering from budget cuts these days. The human program has been kind of limping along since the retirement of the space shuttle, but I think we're starting to see some movement there as well as NASA turns over a lot of the low Earth orbit stuff to the commercial world for servicing satellites or resupplying the space station. It starts to focus on getting people out into deep space again, and back to the moon, going on to asteroids, going to Mars and beyond. I'm really happy to see NASA start focusing on that by rebuilding these big rockets like that can reproduce some of the Saturn V capability. And we'll start to see more testing of that as the years go on.
And as the years go on, it just seems as where we are right now in a manned space program that will probably be several years before we send somebody up again, right?
Yeah, you know, the NASA and other space agencies and companies will be sending people into low Earth orbit relatively soon. You know, the Russians do it all the time now. So, you know, close to home, close to the Earth. I think it's still going to be some time, you know, maybe 5 years, plus or minus, where we start getting astronauts back out into deep space again as this new rocket technology comes online.
The book is fascinating. It's The Interstellar Age Inside the 40-Year Voyager Mission. The book is published by Dutton. Jim Bell, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you so much, Joe. Great to be on the show.
Thank you very much for being with us. Again, the title of the book, The Interstellar Age Inside the 40-Year Voyager Mission by Jim Bell, published by Dutton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.